very much for coming this evening. If I could ask you all, just if I'd remind you to turn your mobile phones off or into silent mode, please, that would be great. Welcome to an evening where we remember and celebrate losers and the art of failing spectacularly well with Brett Steele and Mark Wigley. I think, but neither of them need introducing to the crowd here. I think one of the beautiful things perhaps about talking about failure is that if we're guilty of perpetrating it this evening, you can't blame us. We're just doing our job. So, in fact, if anyone is tweeting out there, you may attempt to damn us over the course of the evening with that newish neologism, hash fail, which has become the quickest and tersest way to denounce something or something, someone or something. And we actually say, bring it on. So whoever wants to fail, whoever wants to utter the words, quote, I failed my driving test for the fourth time, or my marriage failed for the fourth time, or closer to home, mum, dad, I failed my end of year reviews at the AA. Of course not, because life is all about winners. You could say that life is steeped in a romance of success, only till relatively recently history concerned itself exclusively with the deeds of the great and the good, a history full of successful ideas, interventions, inventions, and imaginations. The prize winners, the trailblazers, the lucky few who became the canon, the beautiful and the blessed. But is the opposite of success failure? Can something actually start out as a failure and end up as a success? How does time and retrospectivity interfere in judging success or failure? Samuel Beckett couldn't imagine being alive without failing. It was a measure of one's will. He wrote, quote, go on failing, go on. Only next time, try to fail better. Schopenhauer concluded that emotional, physical, and sexual desires can never be fulfilled, so you might as well not even try. When he did try to teach at the University of Berlin in 1820, he scheduled his lectures to coincide with Hegel's, whom he called a clumsy charlatan. Only 5 students turned up to Schopenhauer's classes, and he dropped out of academia forever, definitely a hash-fail moment. Madeleine Riesendorf once told me that her favorite objects in civilization are not the consensually agreed upon masterpieces in museums, but rather those where you can detect the ambition of the maker and the measure, and then measure the extent to which they fail to achieve this paradigm. That distance between the two is what makes something heartbreakingly human. I fail, therefore I am. Maybe failure isn't synonymous with losing. Are you a loser because you failed, or are you a loser because you never dared to try? I'd like to think, actually, that there is as much of a romance of failure as there is of success. It's just not really ever codified as a horizon of ambition. What would it mean for a school to teach you how to have a failed career, for example? But all of us know, surely, that there are accounts of epistemology, of empiricism, of scientific discovery that asserts failure is inextricable from knowing anything, becoming someone, positing something, especially something new. What if failure is not success's submissive shadow stalker, but actually the very light which allows us to see success in the first place? But now try telling that to any of your tutors for the rest of the academic year. So we're gonna have two short presentations, recollections of a particular moment in time and in history which spectacularly failed and therefore maybe spectacularly succeeded. So I'm going to invite Brett to kick things off.
Thank you. Thank you, Shimon. Thanks, everybody, for coming in. Thank you for coming in this evening. I hate doing events where I have to try and live up to the introduction. It always puts me on edge. It makes me nervous. But I'm going to try and step up to the wonderful introduction, Shimon. Thank you. And I think the point you make about time and retrospectivity means a lot at the outset, because this is going to be, for me, I think a slightly more personal, certainly more retrospective presentation than I would normally do in this room, in fact, than I've probably ever done. really in part because of tonight's topic on failure. It's a topic that Mark and I have had a long interest in fact, and almost from the time we met nearly 20 years ago when we tried to work with it as a topic. It's certainly one I've been thinking about a great deal, but have suppressed in the normal working life of being a teacher and now director of a school that's, of course, known most famously for its successes, as in fact is Mark's position at Columbia. And so we've tried to bring back a topic today that we haven't had a chance to think about too much recently. It is indeed, I think, as your introduction sets up, a serious topic. My expectation is that it won't be entirely seriously presented and discussed tonight, but that'll be, I guess, part of the evening. I want to first thank Mark, of course, for joining us back at the A, a longtime visitor and friend of the school. And this is, I think, the third or fourth of these public conversations that we've had together in different cities, and it's great to have another one here in London. I think our most recent one was another F word, the future, in New York, which we did in the middle of a snowstorm last winter. And so we're staying with the Fs, but I think with probably quite different effect than we had last year when thinking about the future. I've scripted a short introduction here that will be three parts, basically, that will first talk about, share with you just very briefly a few thoughts I have about the way in which failure embeds itself in the life of an architect and in a discipline or a form of knowledge like architecture. Just a few, very few remarks on that. I think anything related to that Mark will say far better and with greater precision, so I'm really just going to offer you a few pictures to think about what he'll be saying. After that, what I'd like to show you is some material from work that we did together now, I guess, a little more than 20 years ago, when he and I were trying to, in fact, put together a school very much like the one that Shimon hinted at in the introduction, which tried to take the topic of failure in architecture seriously enough, in fact, that you could imagine organizing a course around it. We weren't entirely successful, which is why I think many of you won't know this material too well, but we've used this as an excuse to pull that material out, and with that, then, what I'm going to do is turn to Mark to do his
work. I've missed more than 9,000 shots in my career. I've lost almost 300 games. 26 times I've been trusted to take the game-winning shot and missed. I've failed over and over and over again in my life. And that is why I succeed. I miss more than that.
This is a video from now 20 years ago, Michael Jordan in 1999, at the moment that Nike realized they could make more money from Nike and the selling of shoes by celebrating failure than the success of the greatest player of all time. That came out about the time that Mark and I had been doing work on failure originally, and it was about the moment when I think the status of failure within cultural production started changing, certainly in the Northeast of the United States, quite dramatically, and I think we'll be able to touch on that a little bit tonight. My hunch is that, in fact, we're entering a golden era of failure, not just within architecture, but in many forms of culture today. I think the failure of global banking, of global finance, the failure of the planet, which is something that Al Gore has, in fact, turned into a small industry of its own, and any other kind of failure that you can point to today suggests, in fact, that there are forms of culture that almost entirely understand themselves around failure, and yet architecture as a discipline still finds itself quite uncomfortable when trying to confront it. I snapped this screenshot when I asked one of my teams in the DRL several years ago to record the failure messages on their screen over the course of a working week, in which I realized students were coming to schools like this and being told by machines that they're a failure kind of regularly throughout their working days. And I kind of sensed something was happening within the way in which we teach and learn architecture. It was about that time online when the epic fail culture that Shimon hinted at in his introduction began to take off. This world today of images in which anytime something like this happens, somebody needs to tell us that a mistake was made and somebody failed to live up to what they were trying to do. My personal favorite is epicfail.com, which is the running catalog of these that appear hourly from around the world. For example, in this sign of someone trying to teach English, the word prove is misspelled, and so there's the attempt to suggest it's not such a successful poster. Well, tonight's topic, I think, will try and keep the question of failure more closely associated with architecture, and I think the point we'll be trying to make is is really just that architects' images of success often are out of alignment with the forms of success that are achieved through the world, not quite playing out the way in which their drawings or plans might have first suggested. What strikes me is how different architects talk about failure compared to people like politicians or athletes or others who, in fact, embrace failure in various ways for the way in which it drives their own experience and knowledge forward. Not just someone like Winston Churchill, but in this case, Thomas Edison, who, in fact, in the late 19th century developed what he once called a factory of failure in Menlo Park when he founded, in effect, the idea of a modern research facility. He became, of course, the great inventor of the late 19th and early 20th century, creating all kinds of technologies and devices over and over again through a staggering array of failure that he said he and his teams were dedicated to as a way to try and figure out what they really wanted to do. And I think if you compare that kind of reality with the way in which architects treat failure, what you find is, in fact, a more pejorative sense of failure, not as necessarily productive, but in fact as something that at all costs you want to find a way to distance yourself from. And even with the greatness of someone like Le Corbusier, in this famous quote near the end of his life, when some historians have told us that he died a fairly sad man swimming on a beach, feeling still as if he was a failure because those great city plans that he had once dreamed were never realized in the form that he wanted, or his arch nemesis Mies van der Rohe, also later in his life, making a similar point that, in fact, failure was something that he had to travel great distances from and at great anguish to try and escape. That kind of classical sensibility of failure is something that I would argue, even through the core of what we think of as modern architecture, is still very much alive within the discourses and the language and the habits and the beliefs of architecture as we know it. That's all I wanted to do in this opening, is I think as a kind of reminder of this fact that architecture fails all the time. And I think what we're going to try and talk about tonight isn't so much this sense of architecture failing, although this is a very funny example of architects failing in the worst way. This is that building in China that last year fell over when somebody realized a foundation hadn't been put underneath it. They were building so quickly in this expansion of this particular city that they just literally started falling over like dominoes. This is that same building a couple of months later when the interesting problem that it raised, of course, is how do you demolish a building that's tipped over? You can't blow it up, and it's the industry normally does it, so they had to bring out these cats and sort of start scraping away at it. Incredibly embarrassing. I think that form of failure, you could say, we know quite well. Yes, structures can fail, and they fail all the time. The other kind of failure that you could say is built well within the narrative of modern architecture is the failure of architecture and its styles and its movements and its projects and its personalities as an engine to try and draw us forward to a next one that's going to solve the problems of a previous generation. Less is more, Mies said. And several decades later, Robert Venturi simply responded, less is a bore. The failures of modern architecture are what account for the rise of postmodernism. Critics, theorists, historians tell us over and over again in the 1970s and 1980s, to the point that that narrative becomes architecture itself. Every architectural career consists of a path with countless dead ends, unexpected detours, and accidental results. We should recall that all architects fail in nearly every project they ever undertake, in the sense that those projects are rarely realized in the form in which they're drawn. 930 entrants competed for the Yokohama Terminal in the early 1990s, and one project by FOA was selected as the winner. Everyone else, in effect, fails. There were 1,000 entries at Parc de Lavalette a decade before that, and Bernard Schumi's project was the winner, and all others failed. I could go, I think, on and on about that kind of an example. It's one that I think we as architects know well. You could say, I think, to a certain degree, that architectural competitions really are machines for failure. They're machines for driving architects and architectural thinking forward by failing in a proposal and then embodying ideas in a next project. Indeed, most architectural projects, even if commissioned by a committed client or pursued by the most committed of offices and individuals, nonetheless fail to come to life as built structures. Following 10 years of extensive planning in the 1950s, José Luis Sert's plan for Havana failed to be realized when a young revolutionary named Fidel Castro assumed control of the country a year later. Frank Lloyd Wright's comprehensive 1956 scheme for Baghdad, which he had worked on for 5 years, which replanned the central portion of Baghdad and the very zone that the Americans are now building the world's largest embassy, failed to be built when the political regime arrived a year later and decided the entire project was a failure. I think the history of modern architecture over and over again is filled with these kind of examples. I think there's an almost, the failure of structures itself almost becomes its own kind of signifier for a certain kind of project that understands architecture is never quite what architectural theories and their ideas are about. I think there are high road versions, low road versions of these. There are people that somehow sit in between, the famous upside down house in Rotterdam that I'm sure many of you know, Piet Boom's quite peculiar upside down houses that look like failed structures sitting in the middle of that city. There are attempts by others to make buildings look like they'll never fail, almost a comic effect. I think there are projects like this, if one goes through the 19-teens and 20s, that are monuments to the Russian Revolution, Soviet Revolution, that in effect become monuments to failure of peculiar forms. Decades later, monuments like that still being built, and the failure of regimes is certainly part of what accounts for the making of projects around the world. I think this project from Erwin Wurm a few years ago in an exhibition in Vienna, which became a monument, as he said, to a failed lifestyle, the suburban house living on its own, is an example of that. I think over and over again, what we can find is different forms of failure being built into how architects understand their field. Architectural failure has its own detail specialists. The forensic sciences related to building failure, which are the topic of conferences around the world, I think are another example of this kind of activity. I think there's what we could call the failed career model, which Schumann touched on in his introduction, something like this amazing individual who's been working for 50 years and for the last 40 in the American Southwest, Paolo Soleri, who's been trying to realize a visionary project that began in this form in the 1950s when he went to MIT after graduating in Italy and coming to the States, and gradually morphed into a more earthbound form of architecture related to his theory of arcology, architecture and ecology in the 1970s that ultimately translates into this amazing and some consider failed but others heroic site in the desert of Arizona called Arco Santi that Paolo Soleri and several hundred people have worked on since 1970 is an example of a kind of career failure judged not in terms of the number of buildings built, but in terms of the way in which those ideas can eventually be realized compared to an initial proposal. This is Paolo Soleri's current house. This is what that dream became 30 or 40 years later. These are wonderful photographs that Domus has just commissioned in his house in Arizona. The people there in no way find it to be a failure. In fact, this is Lyle Lovett giving a concert at Arco Santi last July, a slightly surreal a performance that ended with Lyle Lovett thanking, God blessing, Paolo Soleri last summer. Bruce Goff is an example of this kind of a figure, you could say, someone who's identified at the age of 12 as an architectural prodigy. Without education, becomes the chairman of a school of architecture in Oklahoma without a degree. Fulfills a productive career, but undertakes a project that obviously sits outside the normal kind of model of how careers are defined. Schools fail. The Bauhaus within a few years of Walter Gropius proclaiming it the future of architecture. This is not that many years after Gropius' original diagram. Gropius, of course, is famously there only 7 years before his chairmanship fails when students vote him out of office in 1926 for failing to teach courses on architecture, they said. The diagrams of early 20th century modernism fail a century later when finally realized, in China of all places, Le Corbusier's drawings, of course, can finally reveal that the thing that he couldn't take into account is pollution in the automobile as a part of the project. So failure in this case becomes a discovery decades later by people other than the original protagonists. And I'm going to stop there in talking about architecture. to now turn to just very briefly an example of the way in which Mark and I were thinking about, when we first met, thinking about failure in different forms. And let's say this is the more personal part of the evening, which is a confession and I think an admission that really failure is always most meaningful when it's personal. That would probably be the extent of my theorizing for the evening. So what I thought I would do with you, and it seems like the right evening for it, is share a few personal failures, which for me has to start with the fifth-year project that I did in Diploma 6 here at the AA, which I completed 9 years before getting my degree in 1995, which some of you will recognize not for the project it is, but for the project that it resembles. In 1986, I traced the Barcelona Pavilion and handed it in as my fifth-year project. It was the 100th anniversary of Mises' celebration, and after searching for months for a project, it seemed an entirely reasonable one to propose. The year before, OMA had proposed that project in bent form for the Milan Triennale, and my thinking was if it was good enough for Mises and for OMA, it had to be fine for a fifth-year portfolio. You can see them in the site that they were given only after deciding they wanted to reinstall the pavilion, having to bend the pavilion and put it inside. It's the first built project of OMA's catalog and featured in SNL XL. It took me 9 years after the preparation of that fifth-year portfolio to finally get my diploma, thanks to Mark Cousins' generous reading of a slightly sketchy history thesis. Built around Lieberhaus, which is one of the projects that I was doing in the late 80s when I met Mark in New York. These are some of the projects that, and this is a 1988 exhibition that was titled Post-Pathetic. Let's see if I have a beamer up here. Post-Pathetic was the title. I was already interested in failure quite a bit. That year in New York, 1988, which is about the year we began thinking about this school on failure, it was the first attempt for us to try and think through how this goes from being a topic in architecture actually to something that might be taught. And for me, it might migrate, and I've shown this image or two in a couple of other settings here, because it became for me the model of how to teach and direct a school of architecture. This is one of the clubs on the Lower East Side where I was trying to learn lessons about organizing a school. This is CBGB's. There were two or three that A students spent a lot of time at in the late 80s and early 90s, was a setting in which Mark and I first began discussing this idea of an institute for failure. In fact, that was a first tentative logo put together by our art director for this institute, which for us became an opportunity to try and think about the way in which failure could be understood not just as a topic within architectural culture, but really as a mechanism for teaching and learning, or maybe not teaching and unlearning what an architect thinks he or she might know about architecture. We spent the better part of 1988 designing the curriculum for the school. This is the back page of an issue of October in, it looks like it's, yeah, this is spring 89, so this would have been the previous, that's the back page of the previous journal. So this would have been late 1988. This is us announcing the Institute of Failure, start a new decade by learning to fail. Applications are being accepted through summer 1989. There's a bit of blurb about modern architecture's belief in success and some information for how people could get in touch with us. I've pulled out a few of those notes for tonight, so I wanted to share them also. Mark hasn't seen them in some time. And I think a bit of time and distance is usually good to try and assess the exuberance of youth. That, by the way, is our calling card in the upper left corner here. These are some of my notes from some of our meetings when we were putting together the coursework for what we thought would be a first robust public program and a seminar series that autumn, which of course never happened and in different ways failed. These are notes, it looks like, from a curriculum meeting that we held. I see BBS, MW, BT, and JB. I don't know who those guys were with us, but...
Oh, I remember.
Do you remember?
Yeah.
The question I've written down is how best to achieve failure, how do we guarantee immense architectural success for those who fail, and then one of the points that was down here, sorry, it's hard to see in this image, it might be easier on the side, but one of our ideas we thought was interesting for a school is that you could enroll for anything between 3 hours and 3 years, and we would leave it to the students to decide. I think our only expectation was that 3 years is sometimes needed by people to really fail spectacularly, and others can do it quite quickly. I think the only rule that we had...
The naturalists.
Yeah, the only rule we had, of course, was that the really serious work had to be done in an afternoon. and which is why we expected the 3-hour students would be probably best. We made several mistakes, I think, in trying to launch the school in 88, 89. This is some of the publicity that we did for it. And I think part of the failure was clearly we spent as much time doing publicity as we did designing the course. But I think the other difficulty is we also outpriced ourselves at a certain level. The rule that we used was that we took the highest fee on the East Coast and doubled it, with the idea that it should cost a lot more to fail than succeed in the world if we do it seriously. Mark worked especially hard with different cultural institutions and journals to try and get word of the Institute out. You can see this is an advertisement in one of the quarterlies from then. At the bottom, one of the things that we got in was a special issue on the architecture of failure that the editors committed to that year right after an episode, an issue on postmodernism and rhetoric. We also thought it would be good to associate ourselves with other serious schools, so you can see us listed here in one of the issues of Assemblage in the late 80s. If you can see us down here under the institutional sponsors of Assemblage, I think I remember Michael giving us a break on the donation that we had to give to be listed as a sponsor. You can see us right here under the Getty Trust, SOM, the Institute of Failure, Inc.
The Getty Trust has just failed.
There you go. See, we were ahead of our time. By this point, I'd been in London for 2 years in diploma school, and Andreas Papadakis gave us a back page or an opening page advertisement about the time the big Decon book came out. Because we had every ambition that, in fact, it could be an international school. It seemed like a topic that would interest students from around the world. Failed careers, failed movements, failed buildings, and failed schools. Come share your personal failures with a school whose only expectation is that you have many more in you. Classes begin sometime around September. Studio courses will meet irregularly. Seminars will be held semi-weekly, and guest critics will visit at unexpected times. And I think that was part of the problem. We let's say, embodied it and didn't just promote failure and its principles. But we also thought it would be quite nice that a school like that didn't need to have a structure. That you didn't need a structure for that. That you could kind of get together when you felt like it. Anyway, it didn't quite work out. This was also the year Mark, of course, was doing a great deal of work on this quite famous show that launches in the summer of 1988, I believe it was, in New York. And you can see one of the ways we tried to get the school set into New York is to associate ourselves with what was going on there. You can see a symposium that Mark was involved in. I think I've got to zoom in on this. Yeah, the symposium for the Decon show. In fact, we got MoMA to agree to put it at the Institute of Failure. Down here, what we called Theater One at the time, which we didn't really have a theater, but we figured if the symposium happened, it would work out. The difficulty, of course, was that none of these guys wanted to come to talk about failure. So it was sort of Mark and me and a few friends having beers, as I recall, that evening. And the reason, of course, we were trying to work with MoMA is because you can think, in a way, they're the center of excellence in modern architecture, right? That's what the museum for decades has been associated with. Centers of excellence are really the larger cultural landscape that we were trying to reframe architectural education in relation to, the sort of thing that nearly every educational institution worldwide now assumes itself having to be, this sort of banal term, center of excellence. We were very much the opposite. We had ruffled feathers by the summer of, this is summer of 89, it looks like June 89. You can see a story in the PA News reports that Wigley Steele failed to launch the new school, so people were sort of making fun of us failing at setting up a school of failure.
Progressive architecture failed 5 years later.
Yeah, see again, we were ahead of our time on this. It turned out in the end that we just couldn't attract students for it, and I'm not sure why yet. Maybe that's something we can talk about a bit tonight. This is some of the lovely artwork that was done, some of the possible logo ideas that our young art director at the time put together for us in 1988. The one that we settled on maybe was a little unfortunate because of its resemblance to a company that was set up a few years ago. Enron was formed in 1985. It was 3 or 4 years older than us. I think it wasn't really that led to the difficulties, although I have to say I was suspicious when our art director left us after we failed to launch the school and he went to work for Spy magazine. which of course is famous for being the first magazine to bring Photoshop into consumer culture. Photoshop was launched in 1990, for those of you that don't know, on Macintoshes only, and our young art director was clearly interested in parodies of different kinds, and I think we suffered from that. I think what really happened in 1990 was in fact a cultural shift, a major cultural shift when failure no longer had the kind of positive connotations that many of us wanted to work with, but as America entered the Gulf War in August 1990, and the culture of failure became the tagline for driving that war. This is George Bush and Norman Schwarzkopf behind him, and a famous line that he uttered to a news reporter during the Gulf War, that failure is not an option. But in fact, failure started to take on a completely different kind of meaning within larger forms of culture and eventually within architecture as we know it. So that's all really timed right around when we finally gave up on this dream of setting up the Institute of Failure. I just want to close with, I was looking through my files and I've kept all of the material from then, and we did at one point in these meetings scribble what we were calling a kind of failure manifesto. I can remember us debating the points, and we went in the end, even though it was a bit retrograde, with 5 points, as we said, towards a wrong architecture for the future. The first one is that where others teach success, the Institute of Failure would teach not only the benefits of, but the actual ability to fail, which is something we believed in deeply. Where other schools beat their competitors by being a step ahead, the next fashion, the Institute of Failure will always, of course, be a step behind. Where other schools succeed in attracting the best and the brightest and the most ambitious, the Institute of Failure will actively seek the meekest, the laziest, and the least capable and look to develop those abilities. I think that was the challenge we often faced. The techniques of failure, this is point four, the techniques of failure are as difficult to teach as are the principles of success. Our curriculum is strong, but we didn't really expect our alumni would be. And the final point, the coming digital age, this is 1989, we write these, the coming digital age offers architects entire new worlds of architectural failure. But failure has a history, and I think the one point we made about the Institute is that we would avoid that history as carefully as we did its future. And that was it. That was about when it ended for us, as I recall, about 89, 90. We didn't attract a single applicant, I have to confess. We entered a few, but no one could make the commitment to come to New York. A few years later, Zach gave me this recently here at the A. A few years later, Hans Ulrich, in fact, held a wonderful show on failure in art in about 1997, a huge group of artists. And what he was intrigued by was, in fact, how the art world has no real capacity for understanding unrealized projects, whereas for architecture, it's kind of built into the discipline. Again, and he speculated also on the idea of teaching a school of art failure, and I think to a certain degree you could say we were simply ahead of our time with our ambitions. My prediction at the end of this introduction is simply that, as I said at the beginning, I think we are entering an incredibly bright future for failure in the world. We are all struggling with the repercussions, like architects worldwide, with an economic system that's now teetering on the brink of failure. You all tried to travel with me around the world, and after a little bit of snow in Heathrow at Christmas, realized that infrastructures are now failing with the regularity of banks. As I said, Al Gore has made a great deal out of the planet failing. And of course, this page, which we all now look at every day, which is your failure in getting to the page that you want to read on your computer screen, which people tell us is now the most frequently read page in the world in the English language. A page that basically tells you can't read the page you want to read. So again, I think we've entered a golden era. My hunch, particularly with the Institute, is that we were simply ahead of our time a little bit, but I think that's maybe something we can talk about. The point I wanted to make at the end, and I'm going to leave this image on, I was browsing this morning on the new Domus website, which I wholeheartedly recommend. In fact, this is the event that's taking place right now across town over in Shoreditch, the first of the events associated with the debate on criticism and architecture today. The Domus, which an A graduate, Joseph Grima, is now editing and will relaunch in a month's time, is our media partner for something Mark and I are quite excited about, which is, of course, the relaunching of the Institute of Failure, which we're going to be doing this summer in 2011 here in London. In fact, here, it'll be hosted here at the AA in June, and so we're going to invite you all to come in. We hope this time to have a little more success than we did last time, mm-hmm. And look forward to it. Thanks.
it's a sort of a bittersweet moment, because we're not sure whether to celebrate our failure or not. I mean, the way I see it is, I mean, at that time, I had just run away from New Zealand, and then was doing this show, and was starting to teach in Princeton, and to do that show and to teach at Princeton was really like going on safari and finally seeing these mythical beasts up front. So it was exactly like having years read architecture magazines like reading National Geographic, and then finally going and seeing the lions and the tigers and so on. And I think as it happened, I have never been on safari, but friends who have done it say quite often what happens, you go and you know the lion is sleeping, right? So actually the Serengeti plain turns out to be kind of a little bit dead. So for me it was a complete shock to see how architects behave, like how the species behaves in its natural environment, which is the Museum of Modern Art. The Museum of Modern Art is like in Africa, like a body of water where all the animals come and fight for supremacy. And then Princeton as a school of architecture was something similar. It was an allied institution. And in fact, the same. So basically, I experienced this whole habitat of architects. And it was a little bit sort of wounded by that experience that the friendship with Brett began and this kind of secret projects, since officially we were being successful at that time, but didn't feel that way. And now that there is this renaissance of failure in the world, I feel that we are obliged to return to our theme and make sure that people understand really what failure is about. I mean, one of the things that's very difficult, for example, one of the early ideas was that there should be this sort of counter version of the Pritzker Prize, which would be to celebrate failure in architecture. But of course, the trouble is actually the list of people that we had in mind for winning the Pritzker were actually the same ones that had won the Pritzker. And so because they became... They really did master the art of producing uninteresting work in the most given the most interesting opportunities, because by definition, being successful, they would be given many, many opportunities to excel, and we were impressed on how little they took advantage of those opportunities. And so, in a way, they would also be the winners of our prize. So we realized after a while that any award that we would make for our category would actually coincide with awards for success in architecture, which led us to suspect that success in architecture and failure were inseparable, and that actually to master architecture was to, as it were, master failure. And this is what led, of course, to the idea of a kind of institute or school, because if to master architecture is to master failure, then we should get into the business of teaching that. But let's try to think again about this question of failure. I mean, banks, economies, structures, students, policies, and people fail. And actually, you can be a failure, and it's not a good thing to be a failure in love, in life, in profession, in sport, and so on. It's basically not a good idea. You're not supposed to be a failure. And yet, of course, the system, if we can say that, is designed to label a number of people failures. And then you, the worst of all, is to label yourself as a failure. I'm a failure. And no matter what your friends say, no, I'm a failure, right? So in a way, there is always in front of you the possibility to be a failure, to fail. And if you fail many, many times, to be a failure, which means you yourself break down. So in a way, failure exists as a kind of threshold for all of us. But at the same time, there is this discourse of success through failure, right? So that always complicates things. Just in the moment in which you're declaring yourself to be a failure, somebody will tell you, oh yes, but you're going to learn a lot from this experience and you're going to be a better person. So there are these two versions going on. One is that you could be a failure, and the other is that actually through failure you might get to success. And this idea of success through failure is supported by two dominant discourses. First, of course, religion, which never tires of saying that success is only achieved through failure, through sacrifice. And of course, the imperfection of your life and of your decisions and of the world itself will give way in the future to some sort of perfect. And it doesn't really matter which brand of religion you choose to to purchase, and you do have to purchase them. There's a price for all of them. And most people seem to have a combination of religions. It's still always aimed towards, so imperfection and failure in the present is actually necessary to achieve success in some sort of ideal future. Then, of course, there's the secular version of that, science, which says, of course, you have to fail, tests have to be failed in order for lessons to be learned. So you have to fail tests, and you have to test to failure, and you have to design tests that will fail, and so on. And of course, in science, it's all about the clarity of your hypothesis, that actually what you're trying to do is to clarify the nature of the hypothesis. But both religion and science, in a sense, have some idea about progress. And religion typically progress towards some timeless state. And in science, progress toward, you know, infinite progress. So then the question is, what the hell is going on in architecture, or what is the nature of the questions that we ask in architecture and so on? And I want to suggest, of course, that in architecture you find a fully formed culture of failure. In fact, perhaps the most perfectly formed culture of failure that exists. So if we have a renaissance of failure in general global culture today, architecture might be able to offer some important lessons. I want to go even further and say, you know, failure might even be an architectural concept. And it's not by chance that the image of failure is not just for architects a collapsed building, but failure itself is conceived of as collapse, as breakdown, as lack of supports, as being shaky, and so on. So basically, to fail is to fail like a building would fail, which also suggests that to construct a building is to construct an image of success. So let's say architects are in the business of creating images of success, of non-failures, and yet what we're suggesting is that this discipline whose sole goal is to produce reassuring images of the possibility of success are endemically filled with failure. Building failure is not like any other form of failure. If a piece of building falls and breaks an old woman's arm, it will be on television. You can kill the same woman with a gun, and it may or may not get onto television, depending on the nature of the day. It's to be killed by a building. What's simply unacceptable in Western society is to be injured by a building. It's just fate worse than death. Buildings are extraordinarily over-engineered to prevent that possibility, and the idea of failure is reads differently. The fact that failure might be an architectural concept is hinted in the expression "back to the drawing board," which is the whole story about first you have to fail in order to succeed. Well, then when you meet failure and say, "Great, I've got failure, so I concede," you go back to the drawing board, and you happily trot back to the drawing board, and not by accident, you go back to an architect's drawing board. So maybe we should start with this drawing board or this screen and see what's going on there. So in the corner of an architect's studio, somebody is working in the dark in order to more clearly see the screen, or more importantly, so that the screen itself is not seen at all, and the person is in some intimate, extraordinarily intimate feedback loop, because the mouse in their hand essentially converts the movement of their hand into electricity, which changes the signals in the computer, which changes the image, which changes the brain's reaction to those images, which changes the electricity in the body, which changes the movement of the hand. So you're in some sort of loop where the electricity of the body and the brain of the body is intimately linked to to the electricity and wires and nervous system of the computer, and not just your computer, but the world of computers. And in such a situation, it's not clear that you are drawing the project or you are simply reacting to your attempt to draw and, as it were, acting as the editor of what you see and making corrections to what you see. And this editing process leads to the evolution of the project. By the way, just as true of drawing by hand, it's not clear whether the paper or the pencil or the person does the drawing. Surely at least all three inseparably. So likewise, somebody in the corner of an architect's office is in some sort of feedback loop, tinkering with the proportions, material, dynamic, shape, and so on of a project, and is subjecting them to a more or less unstated set of parameters and making adjustments accordingly. So endless variations and mutations, with each little variation of a part of the project affecting all of the other parts of the project, changing the performance and like painting one of the rooms in your apartment, which then leads all the other rooms to seem like they need painting, so then you go and paint them, and of course all the rooms painted is a different concept than painting the first room, so then you change the original concept of painting and so on. This sort of endless tinkering by which the project itself seems to, as it were, live and breathe, is visibly moving on the screen, and your machine, not trusting you, is saving a backup file every 15 minutes or so, which could be themselves played back, like this brilliant exhibition of the Muybridge in Tate Britain, where they then took all the still images he'd taken and ran them back as a movie. So you then get to see exactly what you imagine the horse would have looked like, that he would see it. One could, as it were, see the project literally, as it were, living inside the computer. Again, no different than when the project was being done by hand. So this thing is alive and mutating. And then the following morning, you have to present the project, or let's say the latest version of the project, to the head of the office. And one of the ways the head of the office identifies that she or he is the head of the office is by killing your project. So they look at it and treat it with absolute scorn and make you feel that despite the fact that you didn't sleep for the last week, and despite the fact that actually, to your knowledge, you've never been paid, or even if you had been paid, you wouldn't have realized it since you don't have a chance to leave the office. And you certainly aren't sure in which currency that would be anyway, since your papers are not necessarily entirely in order. But you are shamed into going back and reworking the scheme after the master or mistress of the office, having dismissed everything that you have done, highlights the possibility that even within your stupidity, several variations perhaps could, with more serious work, be developed into a realistic project. So now the feedback loop between you and the image you see on the screen now extends to include the head of your office, and this goes round and round for a while, until which point the head of the office is put into exactly the same relationship to the client. And the client now acts as the sort of unimpressed reaction. And then, of course, that feeds it back to the person in the corner of the office, that they have to now change it in response to what the architect believes the client really wanted, and so on. And this goes round and about. After a while, it seemed to be going quite well. So then the consultants start to head in, and then they get very added in. But this is all very successful in the end, and this thing is starting to really move along quite quickly. And in fact, now everybody at a certain moment in time seems entirely happy. At this point in the story, the architect may or may not have realized the extent to which they're going to be paid or not paid, and will be deciding whether to continue with the project anyway. There will be no doubt on the consultant's point of view that if the money is not there, their participation ends. But by now, of course, the architect is in love with the project, since it is, after all, a child. It is a living, breathing organism that has been given birth in their studio, and they're somewhat reluctant to kill this baby off, despite the fact that there's no money to, as it were, nurture this thing into existence. So there's a sort of euthanasia moment, which almost no architect seems capable of killing their projects in, since of course any such project has the potential to be the project that defines not only the great work of that studio, but of that city, in fact of that entire period of history. In fact, this could be the one, and the one could be something as small as the living room for your mother. After all, who else would ask you to do the living room? Or it could be a skyscraper for Frankfurt. It still could be the one, in a kind of Keanu Reeves sense. And I think that was the brilliance of the movie, that he's such a poor actor that it's so implausible that he would be the one, that all of us find ourselves to the very end of the movie thinking surely somebody sitting to his right or left is the one, but anything but Keanu Reeves. And even in the moment in which he's turned into pure information and, as it were, glides off into some sort of uber sexual encounter with the city of the future, we are not sure if he's the one, and so on. But every architect is relatively sure that this one is the one. And by the way, if the architect didn't think that it's the one, could the architect really look the client in the eye with the sense of do it? It's millions of euros, and I can't tell you what's going on here, but do it. It requires this kind of, at least saying to the client, you wouldn't kill this project, would you? I mean, it's so beautiful. You have to remember the great Monty Python sketch, you know, where where he's asked to do an apartment building and he does an abattoir instead. And he's just pleading with him. But look how beautiful it is. The blood flows down here inside. It's the best abattoir ever. But we were asking you for an apartment building. And then he gets on into his, you blackballing bastards with your Tony Jacqueline golf clubs and so on. And it turns out to be, of course, that he's been excluded from the Masonic Guild. And it's the same with every architect. That how dare the client even consider killing this absolutely beautiful child? And this, by the way, also precludes the category of the ugly child, the unwanted child, the misbehaving child, and so on. It's the kind of every child is Michelangelo theory. Which ends, by the way, when the child says to the parents, I think I'm going to be an architect. And at that point, like sort of all options from Michelangelo, they work your way down through lawyers, plumbers, and so on, and finally gets to architect. Anyway, so finally the client has been persuaded and the consultants have been persuaded. So now you have to go to the city and persuade the city. The Georgian society needs to be persuaded. And this requires that at any moment, the project could be killed in a second with one word. Or usually, even more brutally, no words at all. Just the conversation sort of ends and there's no appointment for lunch. Or, you know, there's a sort of a desperate attempt to find out why the signals died. But more than likely, the city, like the client, like the consultants, asks for changes in the design. So it goes all the way back to the person in the corner of the office to change. So this living, breathing organism continues to evolve. But finally, they figure out they're going to build this thing. Then, of course, it hits the value engineers, the facilities management team, and the construction companies and the subcontractors, all of whom interpret and erode the scheme down. But finally, the thing appears on the street of the city. Now, this story is normally told as the sort of heroic survival of a good idea from the brain in the studio to the streets of the city, where the same idea will now be broadcast through the medium of the building to the city. And not only do we not tell the story of all the versions of the project that didn't make it, that died in order that the one would finally make it to the street, but as far as the architect's concerned, it may well have died quite early in the process. So the story of the grand survival of the project is also, in the architect's mind, a story of entropy and erosion, since it may well be one of the very first models that is conceived of in the office as being the project, and everything else is some sort of erosion of realism. So the heroic discourse of creation and construction is paralleled by a discourse of erosion and entropy. And after all, remember, especially these days, but it was always true, from the very first drawing by the littlest person in the office, the building is actually conceived of as built. It's not like an embryonic, no matter what the current generation tells you, it doesn't begin as some sort of abstract set of principles or codes. There is already an idea of what this thing, what this baby will be. Yes, the project might look like a fetus. In fact, that's sort of we are sort of in the whole of architectural discourse seems to have become a kind of prenatal discourse, and this is not by accident, since the very plasma that George Bush didn't want the scientists to play with is exactly those cells that could take any form. So there's a great interest in architecture in this kind of prenatal moment. But this heroic discourse is also paralleled by this sort of nightmare, so that each and every variation of the building was also the death of that building as conceived as it was originally drawn. So even in the heroic successful projects, there are these millions of deaths. Now, one project might survive, awaiting yet another round of feedback and erosion, firstly from the critics, who will leap to the opportunity to point out the faults in the building, and the architectural magazines that will leap to point out the positive things about the building, both being entirely superfluous. Then the users of the building, which no one will listen to them, since obviously the very last thing that's of interest in this whole ecology is to use it. But finally, it will be the historians who will decide whether the building lives or dies. The final arbiters of that will be the historians, which is why architects who essentially don't like historians as a species, I'm speaking as one historian that is, nevertheless every architect wants to be the very best friends with every historian they've ever met. On the off chance, it was not by chance that Gideon is invited to Harvard to give space, time, and architecture by Gropius, who had been clever enough to get Pevsner to finish his book already with Gropius as the endpoint. So finally, the historians make the decision. So what can we say? Architecture as a discipline is all about survival in a series of corrosive environments. So the arrival of the building is heroic simply because it's not dead. And so the goal of the architect, in the name of the game, is actually just to kind of get the building to be not dead, or at least in the sort of undead status. Now, of course, architects can resist these corrosive environments with books and with publications. They can publish their unbuilt work or earlier versions of their work, or they can publish the sketchbooks. They can publish their models, the endless array of models that they produced, thereby keeping those models alive, as it were. They don't throw anything out, so their offices are filled with the corpses of these dead projects. They can rework the images of the built work to make the built work look more like the original work. They can use ideas from the project that died in a project that's coming to life in a kind of genetic engineering by which a sort of organ transplant operation. And clearly there are kind of rejections and, you know, it's a kind of Christian Barnard kind of thing. Dead projects could almost be argued to form a kind of nutrient or fertilizer for new projects to grow. So I think one of the reasons architects keep all of the dead corpses of their projects around is rotting, literally rotting, usually, literally rotting away in their offices, is out of this nutrient, out of this soil, will be produced the new project. But mainly, and this is the point here, the architect has to absorb the fact that so little survives. Architectural archives, like architectural offices, are mortuaries overflowing with unnamed victims of this horror, which is architectural commissions. The architect has to again and again and again fall in love with a newborn child, a project, treat it as real, even clothe it, and think about how it would feel in the weather and all of that, even teach it a few things, and then watch this new child be killed in front of you, immediately move on as if nothing has happened, with the same sense that you have in all of those movies where you see an unimportant member of the military shoot in the head a seemingly, by definition, unimportant but important enough to kill, but not with more than one bullet person. This sense of the a brutality that's brutal in its innocuousness, in its everydayness, in the lack of anything extraordinary about it. This is happening to architects all of the time. Think about it. The ratio between dead projects and surviving projects is simply astonishing. It's beyond measure. It makes World War I seem incredibly short and with remarkably few casualties. Like, makes World War I look like a good idea, a good way to sort of resolve certain border disputes. Architecture is pure carnage from beginning to end. And as in the war, perhaps architects have had to develop a kind of numb distance from their own children. You have to be passionately in love with the child in order that the child could live, but have no sadness when the child is killed, sometimes almost, as it were, by your own hand, because you failed to make some key... you didn't turn up to the meeting, for example, which is actually often now how it happens, the sort of absent father or mother problem. The architect, as you know from and as I've tried to point out in the past, is never seen to smile in photographs. Now I start to understand why. I mean, there's not much to smile about. But also in terms of the war, the architect is never crying either. Architects take their fate amazingly, like the 973 losers, take their fate with a certain, almost as a compliment in a certain sense. And as with a professional soldier, a special kind of professionalism has developed in our discipline, a very refined survival instinct, such that you could love the person you're fighting with dearly, knowing that they are the last person you are likely to talk to, and know things about them that you never have known with anybody else in your life, and you will ultimately see parts of their body that you will never have seen of any other body in your life. But in the moment they die, you yourself would die quickly afterwards were you to be overcome with grief at this. So you develop a certain amazing ability to be completely in love and dependent, and then in the moment in which the thing you're dependent on is gone, are unaffected, even strengthened, one more layer of distance is added, one more layer of clarity is added to your vision to avoid the next bullet, the kind of bullet that hit that other person. So the paradoxical symptom of the carnage of architecture is this sort of absurd optimism that architects all have in common, that relatively small changes to the built environment create the image and therefore the possibility of a better society, which is what we all desperately and romantically believe in. This becomes an amazing ability to keep this optimism alive. So architecture from this point of view is the Darwinian ecology of survival taken to its an unbelievable extreme. You could say that we're well trained for that. Survivor, not by accident, is the name of the kind of Uber, the paradigm of the reality TV show, in which every week there will be attrition and every week you have to pretend to like people you don't like in order to be the survivor. But of course there's also Big Brother, Top Chef, Bachelor, Let's Dance, Project Runway, Biggest Loser, my current favorite, Biggest Loser, which surely makes a total reversal of everything we think about failure. It's a group of people designated as failures try to succeed. This, of course, is taken over from sports, from competitions in general, and from music. I mean, the top 40 and the top 10 don't really work anymore in the digital age. Really, these reality shows have taken over as sort of training for how to survive in a market economy, like how to know that some people are going to win and some people are not. And when you get the message that you're not at the top, that's okay, because that's the nature of things. But again, I want to insist on how radical this Darwinian logic is in architecture. I mean, after all, only about 10 architects get to the top of the top of the top, right? Get to be annoyed that they didn't get the Pritzker Prize. That's an interesting category, those who thought they should have got it and didn't get it. Why we don't blog about that, why we don't talk about that, is a symptom of our disinterest in failure, is that there's just no discussion about who should have won. In any other major event, Lionel Messi wins the Golden Boot, should have been Iniesta or Xavi, right? I mean, it's a really interesting discussion. It's waging all over the internet, despite the fact that Messi is clearly not human. Beyond human, there's still all this discussion. When somebody wins a Pritzker Prize, there's a little murmuring in the trenches of those who are in the know. And the sign that you're in the know is that you know who thought they really should have gotten, who's upset about it. But you would never go public with that, because that would be like talking about failure. Le Corbusier, of course, is our most amazing example, because the most influential of architects all dies incredibly bitter. So therefore, our role model, all of us, are aiming towards disappointment. The highest accomplishment in our field would be to be as disappointed as Le Corbusier. So we have to aim to be as disappointed as him, and each of us achieves a certain measure of disappointment relative to that. Of course, historians, even despite the fact that there are 10 people in a group of people who thought they should have got the Pritzker, historians just basically clean everybody out, and there's whole periods of time in which there's nobody rates at all, as Raina Banham so beautifully pointed out. Nobody between 1910 and 1923 was of any interest to any historian, because it sort of upset their story. So you can be the king of the hill, and our students will be responsible for removing the very fact that you existed. So more importantly, all of this carnage, this endless variation within architecture leading to these very isolated examples of survival, makes architecture's relationship to the economy, especially to the market economy, completely seamless. Because what we're describing here is an infinite capacity for variation. Architects can do anything with the forms, and have to and do. So architecture has become infinitely sensitive to environmental conditions, so responsive that it hardly exists. There's no friction, let alone resistance. That whole discourse about parametric design is just a very, very watered-down version of the architect's dream to be in a frictionless relationship with the market economy. This professional culture of failure starts at school, or rather it's the whole point of the school. The whole point of the school is to get you into the mood that failure is really the thing that you should aim for, reinforced by the mythology of no success until your 40s, eternal education, marry when you're 101, that kind of thing. Architects, like fascists, seem to live forever because they're just looking for the next project, the next child. When somebody 101, 102 years old in Brazil, has another child, and that child is a city. There is such a thing as sort of dangerous parenthood. Anyway, schools literally fill up with the corpses of ideas during a semester. You're at the beginning of a semester, the school is kind of clean. Hard drives are kind of clean, well organized. Brett's books are perfectly organized on his bookshelf. But during the course of the semester, waste space baskets, rooms, and hard drives, and cloud surrogates, all those things, will now fill up with dead projects. The narrow stream of images that will emerge in the books and websites of our schools will be portrayed as success, as the refined results of scientific testing and so on, rather than as the beneficiaries of, or even as the examples of, failure. But here's my only question here. How the hell can you fail now in architecture? If we have the world's best developed culture of failure, how can you really fail? Since we've just pretty much comprehensively developed this culture of failure. So again, I agree with the Beckett quote. The question would be probably how to fail better, or what are the new forms of failure available to us? And therefore, the original idea of our Institute of Failure, which was to sort of learn from the death of ideas rather than from their survival, concentrating on the moment of kind of cutting, the moment of death, putting the moment of death into slow motion, as it were, to try to understand what was going on, savoring the beauty of failure, the lessons of failure, not for the future, like not the lessons of sacrifice, not saying, oh, let's go back and look at failure because there'll be new forms of success, but actually trying to be closer to death, decay, mistakes, confusion, misunderstandings, and so on. Probably something close to the surrealist, or maybe it's a sort of latent branch of surrealist thought, looking to produce real failure, or at least sort of friction, at least trying to develop. And figures like Cedric Price seem to me come to mind as sort of splendid, to use his own words, potential examples of sort of self-induced failure, or failure as a performance art. To summarize all of this, I think we fail to celebrate how good we are at failing. I mean, we're real professionals. Nobody does it like we do it. This requires a vast amount of collaboration across continents and across time. It requires every school to be synchronized to this mission. Nobody's dropping the ball on this one. You know, failure is just cultivated and suppressed. We ever so carefully avoid the temptation to savor the mechanics of failure itself. The jury, source of a diversity of opinions. A firing squad, if ever there was one, right? As you nervously, barely alive, chemically supported not by your legs, but by whatever chemicals got you through the last 2 minutes, as you try to produce a plausible narrative linking your drawings to what you believe the jury wants to hear, and all that you hear while you're saying this is the cleaning of weapons. And they've got different kinds of weapons, so one of them is going to get you in there, right? So too big to fail, right? It's as if our discipline too big to fail. I think a history of failure is a good first step, and I think this is why I somewhat reluctantly, but now I'm totally for it, agreed with Brett's suggestion that we need to confess kind of how pathetic our efforts were back in the 80s. But we are looking for new forms of failure, and we think you could help us accomplish that. And that's all I've got to offer. I hope there's nothing positive in what I've said. no sort of key terms that could be guided towards success. For those of you parametrically inclined in the audience, please don't interpret the fact that we have developed perhaps the world's largest capacity for innovation, for an endless modulation of form in the most multidimensional, name a discipline that's more multidimensional, that architects have developed a capacity to, in real time, endlessly change form in response to unpredictable and multiple environmental conditions, and we're doing it before the computer came and now doing quite well with the computer, and we'll do quite well after the computer. Don't think of that as a positive. All it does is ensure the disappearance of architecture, right? It guarantees that narratives about success can continue. It is a kind of harikari done globally. Anyway, sure.
Thank you, Mark. I think think maybe for the next 10 minutes or so, we'll keep this really casual. Nick's got a couple of microphones, so I would really, while I maybe just start things with a couple of questions, if you can just put your hands up, and then we'll, for the sake of the video recording, if you could wait for the microphone to come, and just butt in, and we'll do that, I think, for the next 10 minutes or so. Does anyone have a question straight away? Mark, of course, does.
To ask, in a sense, what the function is in kind of owning up to failure. I mean, one way of kind of getting into it is whenever I advise someone who's going to be examined for a PhD, there's always a moment at the beginning of the PhD when the examiners say, you know, would you like to sort of say in general terms, you know, what you think your thesis was and what it achieved? And the smart candidate says, you know, I started off trying to do that, but now when I finish, I realize I've actually failed to kind of answer the question. Now, this is because, as it were, one of the functions about taking on the responsibility for your own failure is it immediately demobilizes other people's aggression. And to some extent, they think they can sort of trust you, because if, as it were, you can be trusted to say of your own thesis, actually, I think it sort of failed, in a way, then that's the kind of person who's going to succeed in the examination. Now, I mean, the question really is then, I mean, the heaping of one's own failures. And I mean, it certainly analytically, it's a completely successful technique. If you walk into a room where you know people are extremely critical of you, they're just not yet saying it, for God's sake, say it yourself before they get round to it. Once you say it yourself, it immediately demobilizes their aggression. And so, you know, one can bring a certain type of psychoanalytic skepticism to the confession of failure, that it is a sort of guarantee against, you know, perhaps as it were, what the architect really can't deal with is criticism. And in a sense, the robing of themselves in the self-confession of failure is the way, they hope, of demobilizing criticism.
Mark? Could I actually, since you kicked things off this evening, Brett, by saying that you're gonna make it a personal confession.
Personal.
It's personal. Yeah. We're amongst friends here. I wonder how much, for both of you, how much was the failure of the Institute of Failure the spur to then have what would be considered by many phenomenally successful careers? Mm. And where, how much was the interest in the concept or the promise of failure something that you a kind of luxury that you could afford before, as it were, your careers became successful?
Well, nobody believed it in the Institute.
I remember.
I mean, the level of skepticism was pervasive. Which, you know, in theory, that should have attracted students, now that I think about it. I mean, but this thing about phenomenally successful careers, by what measure? If the measure is how good your hi-fi is, or, yes, you're right. If the measure is, but what would be the measure? And I think the reason that we hang out together then, when you were writing about the cleaning of Lieberhaus, which was this brilliant argument that a modernist masterpiece devoted to a corporation would as it were, shine its image of cleaning products by shining its own building. I mean, this was not the story told in the Museum of Modern Art about that building, which is very close and all of that. So there's a certain... The reason we continue to hang out, and the reason the AA in Colombia continue to hang out, is there is at least the hypothesis in both schools that ideas will be entertained that are so off that any level of success with that idea might contribute to the evolution of the field. So they're basically set up as laboratories for experimentation. Now, have those two schools been phenomenally successful in the evolution of the field? I'm really uncertain about that, because it's just not clear that the field has evolved. I think there could be, you know, we could replace both schools with more or less academic institutes devoted to try to monitor the relative success or not in architects in contributing to images of better society. Which, if that's what gets us together, all architects, the thought that you could create through building, as it were, create images of the aspirations of society. That if architecture is at its core aspirational, fragile, dealing with thoughts, desires about what could be a better place. We don't have a feedback loop on the discipline saying, well, how are we getting on with that? And, you know, one could argue that architects have never contributed less to society's image of itself than now. I mean, there would be that argument. In which case, you'd have to say ourselves and our schools represent horrendous failures to contribute significantly. This school is an interesting case, right? Because it so many of the people in that top 10 were born here. So, did it happen? No.
It came up in a question I remember last spring when we got together about how we might see the relationship between these two schools. And I think a point was made, it was actually by someone in the audience and not either of us in that conversation, that you could say what distinguishes Columbia and EA is very much not just that they're good quality schools, but they're by definition and by almost self-will experimental schools. They're schools that believe in the idea that architecture is something to experiment with and not to simply succeed at or achieve. And I think, and it touches, I think, on a couple of points Mark was making about the scientific discourses of experimentation that build forms of failure and, in fact, embed them quite deeply within cultures of science and knowledge. And I think there is a form of architecture that is still genuinely experimental today that, in fact, is that not because of the output or not because of the attitude of the protagonist, but because of a way of working and thinking that doesn't just embrace, but that, in fact, expects failure. And in fact, I think schools like this one we're in tonight, are interesting in part because they have mechanisms and infrastructures for getting failure out there faster and in almost forms of regularity that can simply drive ideas and thinking forward. I think, and my concern with architectural culture more generally is that kind of a culture is failing today. I think there is, in many different ways, a kind of failure of an experimental project that is more a failure of that attitude than the particular results or projects that we see out of it. I was thinking of the question Mark posed, which is why confess failure today? And I think part of our presentation this evening is in a way presenting some of our own youthful failure in how we teach. And I suppose in a way that's also trying to reassert architecture, in that I've always believed architects tend to get things last. And one of the points we're making tonight is that we suddenly find ourselves in a world of failure, and we should wake up to that rather sooner than let this condition linger on and think that architecture is somehow outside that. I think architecture has gone through a period of success that, as a field, as a discipline, it simply never experienced before. We have reached you know, by 2008 or 9, the longest wave of building and construction and urbanization in human history over 15 years, the largest wave ever. And at the time we were first meeting and talking in the late 80s, nobody had any image of that even being a possibility. I mean, at a certain level, I do think we were simply embracing failure at the wrong time. I mean, architecture and its culture was swept over by success in forms that are simply staggering still, I think, for many of us today to realize. I mean, there are teachers in this school who might live in Holland, come to London for a day a week, fly to China to build the world's tallest tower, fly back, and on Monday teach again with their students. And at a certain level, that's a definition of professional success that architecture simply couldn't have imagined 20 years ago. And in fact, that generation that now today is hailed at the pinnacle of a Pritzker kind of recognition of success within the profession, those individuals being in a building like this in the 1970s when nobody had an opportunity to build, let alone construct, you know, ideas that were still at an early stage in their careers, is simply a very different and quite, I think, remote condition to the idea of what an experimental project can be today. And I think we don't have a definition clear or believable, but I think there is still a belief that that kind of an experimental project can return. It will simply return in a very different condition in which failure is going to be measured in extremely different ways than it has been in the past.
Right. I mean, it's certainly a different environment when there's no... You can raise the question, are schools like these, you know, what is the research capacity? Like, what's able to be done in these laboratories? There's no question that China is an astonishing laboratory. It's the biggest experiment in the history of the planet that's going on in China. There's no question. Now, what's the relationship between the experiments in places like this and the experiments there? That's not really thought through very much. It's possible, if more or less what we're saying is true, which I think it is, that there is a sort of a thought in the architectural world that architecture itself is not possible. But actually it's never accomplished. It's always compromised. It's always a loss. It's always not quite what it should have been. It's as it were, architecture can only be disappointing. And that then puts the architects in a kind of utopian mode. I mean, so this really, so almost consciously, architects know that what they are talking about cannot be done. That even in, you know, it's never can quite happen. And the architects that are celebrated for getting close. So you can, as it were, as you said so beautifully following Maddie, you can feel what didn't, you can feel the melancholy. So you have to feel the dream and its lack of accomplishment. So then that makes the most beautiful buildings our field has produced those that communicate the gap between an idea and its realization, not an idea. So it's about, you know, it's more about grieving, you know, for that which is not there. How do you take a discipline so thoroughly organized around this melancholy, right? A sort of a sweet melancholy with the great experiment of the just movement of 85% of the world moving into cities that didn't exist before. I mean, just, you know, the implausibility of even simple architectural ideas on the one side and the total reality of seemingly impossible gargantuan movement of resources and people on the other. The relationship between these has not been thought through. We are, of course, in a certain sense, the children of Alvin, directly and indirectly, directly through the school, indirectly through Bernard Tschumi, who takes the model of the AA to New York, and so on. So, you know, you almost want the ghost.
Yeah.
You know, you want to say, okay. Now, the two options here. One is that would be, which form of melancholy would we look for in this new world? Does it mean to make an entire city and not be have the city quite the way you want it? I had breakfast with a graduate of our school in Beijing last year, and I don't know if he's started to shave yet or not. I mean, he just seems youthful beyond belief. And I said, what are you going to do after this breakfast? He says, I'm going to finish the city. I have to finish the city. And it was his second city he was working on. So, how do you then measure? Okay, so again, how do you measure the success of a school? I don't know.
Anyone else? Carlos?
I think it's very interesting what you were saying there, Mark, because I think the one of the things that's interesting about what you two have been saying is the difference between the academic side of what success might be in architecture as opposed to what it might be within the profession. And China is unique. I mean, the first time I went to China, which is 1992, we met the people from Beijing, and the intermediate students were building schools, and the diploma students were laying roundabouts. That's before the boom. Okay, so, I mean, you know, they said, excuse me, I've got to go because I've got to lay a roundabout. So, you know, it was extraordinary. So I think that is different. But I think one of the questions that I would say, I liked your analogy that if you are working in practice, you know, certain ideas emerge, you have your baby, as it were, then it gets watered down and it goes on. But you collect the bodies, in the office. You know, you can have the projects that weren't realized. It was a good idea. You might reuse it and so on. I like that kind of sort of idea, although I don't like the dead baby, but I like the idea of what you were trying to say. I think maybe that's one of the problems that we have as schools, is that we don't have a mechanism to hold back a lot of the ideas that emerged within the architectural projects. Right. So as you were saying, the publications show the creme de la creme of projects. They don't show the failures. And it's quite difficult within an institution to hold back those ideas because they're still done by individuals within the school who then move on. And I think that's a great pity. And I think if we were to bridge the gap between, you know, monumental things that are happening at a global scale with what ideas are emerging at schools, maybe we would need to be able to make the schools more discursive with the outside in terms of the ideas that were also lost, not the ideas that were a success. Because I've always felt that that's one of the things that we all lack, is, you know, fantastic things get discussed, they disappeared, they weren't the one that won. And I think we probably produce more within the schools than the profession does out there. And I think maybe that's where it lies. So maybe we have to find a way of collecting some of the failures in a more successful way that will contribute to the outside.
No, I think it's a wonderful point, Carlos. And I think the question for schools might also be to how might they recognize that might be beyond their capacity, that in fact schools, and with every good intent, I mean, schools like the AA or Columbia are almost, I mean, they're amazing machines for churning material and work and trying to hold on to it. We all know it slips away. Really, you cover every surface in this building once a year with every possible drawing that can fit. 3 weeks later, and I have a wonderful collection of photographs of this place being torn apart at the end of that process over the years, and it all just disappearing. And I think what we're seeing happen around us, and this is, I've thought about it very much with our idea of trying to bring the Institute back in real form today, 20 years later, is to tap into the various, not necessarily technologies, but platforms that are doing that. I mean, like Joseph's event tonight across town is, two or three of the people are in the space downstairs at Shoreditch. Jeff's in San Francisco, we're over here. We're going to converge for a moment and look at the material that was presented, but it's all now available. We might need a set of links and connections and recordings to get to it, but increasingly this material is now, it doesn't disappear. You know, it doesn't any longer in a discipline like this. And part of it is media, I mean, but part of it is also, I think, the arrival of kind of archival culture that didn't exist through a certain wave of modernism. I mean, the AA famously has no archive for decades at a time. I mean, there's a sort of blank period from Denise Scott Brown in 1952 to James Gowan in 1971. Tony Fretton, who's just given us a project for a show that we're doing here in a month's time, is the class of 72. That's right the moment when suddenly stuff starts to... But there are these kind of blank periods because stuff was on pieces of paper and it just got thrown away. And I was telling the story of the Dan Graham installation here a couple of years ago that I found out in a skip, because we didn't quite realize who it was or what it was, or, you know, and it was spectacular kind of evidence of stuff just piling up and getting tossed out. And that material is being produced today in forms in which it is, in fact, alive beyond just the kind of loop that you're talking about, but circulating outside this in very real terms that I think will change that. I think it's how this, schools like this negotiate themselves with that, to a degree model themselves after various kinds of emerging platforms, but also I think allow those platforms to infiltrate their own borders and walls to kind of work within us. That'll be really interesting. Yeah. It'll absolutely revolutionize our understanding of ourselves to that world around us, because the world around us can do the work on us rather than us having to sort of think of the right way to sort out that relationship. We've got to rely on others to come across the accidental models that might do it.
I mean, I think that there's a pretty impressive increase in the bandwidth of schools and of architects and of offices and so on. I think that the question of interface becomes very important. We tried a studio last year, which was very successful, which was to have 30 people in their own studio, which was sort of set up as a kind of Cape Canaveral, and they were broken into teams of two that would invent ideas, right, in the first few weeks. Then any other team in the room could use your idea, but they'd ask your permission. And if you gave permission, you had to also maintain it. So if your idea was for a kind of flexible wall system or something, and then they put it on their project, it didn't really work, they could bring it back to you and you'd have to fix it. So you don't give your idea to just anybody. You have to kind of... But the idea was of course, that there'd be a sort of self-consciousness about all of the invention going on, and it would be an archive. And then... that all of that information would then be available to the students who will do the same studio this year. So just like next week, another group of 30 students will start now with the end. So it's an attempt to, and I don't think the wheel will come out of it, or chocolate or anything other important things like that, but a sort of awareness of the ecology will come out. And one thing I disagree with you about is I don't think that schools are more interesting than professional offices, in this sense that I think there's been this huge change, because if you're a professional office and you have to do a skyscraper in China, you now have to have a research capacity like schools used to have. And so many offices move more quickly now. And it's, I think there's going to be a sort of emerging of research capacities in certain offices and certain schools. And it's going to produce a sort of unholy alliance. But that unholy alliance may well expand to include manufacturers of materials, and there'll be a certain blurring of education in relationship to the economy and things like that, which will cause us all a lot of angst. But all of that will once again increase the capacity. So we'll have a much more enhanced research capacity. Now, will we have the ability to use that in any interesting way? I don't know. Will the world meanwhile have increased its capacity even more quickly, so we're just moving? I have no idea. But I think that if your daily life involves trying to increase the capacity of a school to be an intelligent, responsive system, something like a brain, in this moment in time, you find yourself wondering what's the limit of this technology. Could be that schools of architecture are like newspapers. They're great. They're just great, but they're also dying fast. So as a technology, an architecture school might be redundant. Now, I've always thought that, no, we have the magic weapon, which is studio, because studio is a place for embracing the unknown. I mean, it's just more than even an artist studio. An architect studio is set up to deal with unknown problems in unknown ways for unknown situations. So I've always thought that was more or less bulletproof, that that's actually going to become more and more valuable with time.